Hey, denk dran, dass auch dein Immunsystem Hunger hat. Und probier's mal mit den Gesundheitszielen zur Ernährung in der App Auka Navida. Hol dir Tipps, Rezepte und Challenges für dein gesünderes Ich. Jetzt die App Auka Navida downloaden und loslegen. Auka Plus. Aus Liebe zur Gesundheit.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast, where we discuss RPGs of all different sizes, big and small, Japanese, Eastern, you name it. That's because it's the genre that we love the most. And this week, we have our returning guest, Elliot Gay, our Japanese correspondent, who plays all of the import RPGs. He is here to talk to us about Persona 5, SMT Apocalypse, Super Robot Wars, OG, The Moon Dwellers, and whatever else we can think about. Is there anything else that you've been playing, Elliot?
I finished Tales of Berseria before I moved on to Persona 5. So.
All right. So maybe we'll get to that one, too. All right. But obviously, the big one, Persona 5, it is out in Japan. Elliot has been playing it, and from the sound of it, it is doing very well. I've heard reports that it is number one and number two on Japanese bestseller lists.
Yes, actually, I got the numbers right here. Between the PS4 version and the PlayStation 3 version, its opening week, it sold 337,767 copies, which is the highest debut for any game in the series. Up until that point, I think Persona 4 had been the highest first week at like 200,000, give or take.
So this is combined.
Yes.
That's still nothing to sneeze at. People might like look at 300,000 copies in Japan and go, eh, whatever. But this is the Japanese market where we're talking about, where releases numbers are often measured in the tens of thousands,
yeah,
rather than the hundreds of thousands or millions. And any game that sells like a few hundred thousand copies is a rousing success.
Yeah, and I think it's easy to forget, too, that Persona, for as much as it's caught fire in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, up until Persona 3 and 4, and even with Persona 3 and 4, it was a relatively smaller RPG series. I mean, you talk about the Tales franchise that used to sell in the 500,000 to 600,000 range. Persona was, like, in the tier below that, as far as numbers is concerned. So this is a huge jump for the series and kind of is a testament to how Atlus has nurtured the brand since they released Persona 4.
Yeah, it really feels like it took off. Like, it's always been kind of around, going back to the old, well, Megami Tensei games and the fact that it was based on a Japanese novel and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But it really feels like the series has kind of gone to the next level since Persona 4. Especially right after Persona 4 Golden came out, it felt like Persona 4 merch was everywhere.
Yes.
Persona 4 characters really seemed to take off in the Japanese mindshare. I know that Persona 5's announcement was a big deal over in Japan. You were there in Japan at the time. Is that pretty much corroborating what you're seeing?
Yeah, you know, I mean, the thing is that Persona fans are really... Japanese Persona fans are really diehard fans. Like, a lot of... the money that goes into the series isn't just from the games, but like you said, it's from the merchandise, it's from the concerts, etc. Their fan base is very loyal, and so they can hold concerts, even though the franchise only pulls numbers, you know, like 200,000 a game, give or take. They can still hold big concerts at event halls and stuff because fans will show up for them no matter what. But yeah, the Persona 5 announcement was treated like a big deal. It got this kind of very cool sort of, I don't know, like... what's the word for it? Fake staged theft at like a concert where the Phantom Thief showed up and like stole the lights and stole all like the power.
Oh, that's really cool.
It was a huge deal. And I mean, a lot of English speaking fans who watched these streams kind of felt lost or were annoyed by how much nothing would happen on them for hours on end. But like, Japanese game industry is kind of used to having streams where people just goof around for a while and nothing really important happens. So for the Japanese fans, it was just kind of, you know, goofy fun.
Yeah, that's what I've heard, actually, that Japanese streams are a lot less focused and a lot more just like, let's just goof around.
Let's
have a good time. Let's just chat.
There's no new news here. We're just talking with the voice actors.
Yeah. Yeah, I find that it's pretty interesting. You would think that it would be kind of the opposite, right? You would think that the Japanese streams would be much more focused and that American streams would be just kind of like goofing around, but go figure.
Yeah, I figure one of the big differences, too, is that like a lot of Japanese fans are also following their favorite actors and such. So if you get, you know, right, the voice actors on the show and there's no new news, but they're talking to the voice actors, that's enough for the fans, you know what I mean? They come away from that show thinking, oh, that was a good time. Versus if someone, you know, from the West was watching the stream hoping for new clips, they come out of a two-hour stream with nothing and they feel like they got burned, you know?
It makes me think of kind of the variety show slash Japanese television culture, where you just get these celebs hanging out on a show,
yeah,
right? Because they're a celebrity and therefore people like them and they'll... Japanese television, like, everybody is like, oh, Japanese television is so crazy. No, most Japanese television is a panel of celebrities ooing and aahing over food.
Sometimes even the news,
yes,
which seems kind of weird, but...
Yes, exactly. All right, Elliot, you have been playing Persona 5. How far are you? And what are your initial thoughts?
It's been about a week since the game released, actually exactly a week. I am 40 hours into the game.
Oh my god, okay, wow.
I know.
You've been, like, basically just playing it straight through. You've been going crazy on it.
You know, I didn't intend to. I don't play games like this normally, in terms of, like, just sitting down and jamming it out. But since I got it on day one, I've just been sitting in front of it as often as I can. I mean, it's probably more than 40 hours because I've lost chunks of time due to party wipes and stuff. But, yeah, I'm about 40 hours in. I just finished what is the third dungeon, and there is nothing even remotely close to the end in sight.
Oh, man. Yeah, I heard this game is going to be 100 hours just for a basic playthrough.
I don't feel like I'm halfway through.
Oh, my God. But that makes me so excited because I was sad to leave the world of Persona 4
exactly,
I was done with it. So, like, I am really pumped to be playing Persona 5, and it sounds... It makes me really happy to hear that, like, you are, like, 40 hours in, and it sounds like you can't put it down.
I can't. Honestly, if I wasn't recording this right now, I'd be playing more Persona 5 instead of...
Oh, my God. Now I'm just, like, it's coming in the mail for me tomorrow, so I'm really looking forward to playing it. All right. So, tell me a bit about how the game is structured. Is it kind of... I know that your character, they're, like, in a reform school... it's once again kind of going through the year in the same sense of Persona 4 and Persona 3. You have wacky adventures, like the principals trying to get you expelled and everything. So it sounds like the structure is pretty, like, similar to before.
Yeah, the structure is definitely similar to modern Persona, in terms of you have a calendar year, you're a transfer student, and basically throughout every month you have a goal, so to speak, that you have to kind of complete before, you know, the time limit approaches. Unlike Persona 3 or Persona 4, though, the amount of days you have to complete that goal isn't determined by, like, a specific set thing. Like, in Persona 4, it was whenever the mist comes in, that's when, you know, it's time, you're screwed. You know what I mean? In Persona 3, it was as soon as, you know, that specific shadow appeared, that was the time limit. In Persona 5, each dungeon has its own specific reason for its time limit. This isn't a spoiler, it's very early in the game, but for example, in the first dungeon, the time limit is basically until a faculty meeting, because that's when the bad guy in question is going to have his chance to basically get you expelled. And, you know, it's funny, describing that, it sort of sounds like goofy hijinks, but ironically, Persona 5 is easily the darkest of the modern Persona games, and maybe even closer in tone to Persona 2, in terms of...
Ooh, interesting.
So I know a lot of people like to talk about how Persona 3 is, you know, very dark and kind of gritty. And I can see that in the sense that, you know, that they use the guns to summon their personas. And visually, it's very dark. And, you know, they're dealing with monsters and death and such. But it's all very based around supernatural elements. You know what I mean? The darkness of that game, every character has a tragic backstory. But that tragic backstory is almost always related directly to something supernatural that happened. You know, the shadows. Persona 5 is much more grounded in reality, and so the darkness they're dealing with is hits much closer to home because there are actual issues in Japan. You know, we're talking about suicide, we're talking about teacher physical abuse, we're talking about teachers in Japan using their position to try and get sexual favors. We're talking about
yakuza
extorting money. We're talking about basically people beating their employees at work. Excuse the ambulance in the background. yeah, we're talking about very hard issues that don't actually have a supernatural slant until you get into the gameplay element of the game, which is going into people's consciousnesses and stealing their hearts, which essentially reforms them and forces them to confess to their crimes and owe up to what they did. But that's the supernatural element. The supernatural element, it doesn't come from what the person's actually doing. What the person's actually doing is real bad stuff in reality, you know what I mean? And I think that makes things like, okay, well, you're going to get expelled from school, and the reason for that is because you get transferred to this new school because you got arrested for a crime. I won't spoil what the crime is, but you did something, and you got arrested for it, and you got kicked out of school for it, and basically you're the shame of your area, and your parents just shipped you off because they didn't want to deal with you. And so when you get to the school, everybody already hates you. The principal thinks you're a piece of garbage criminal. Your homeroom teacher in front of you talks about how she doesn't want to have to deal with you because you're just a punk kid. All the students are scared of you because they all heard rumors about how you got sent there because you're a criminal. Nobody wants to be your friend. The person you're staying with took you on because he's getting paid to do it, so he doesn't care. So you're in a situation where you are absolutely just the outcast of society. And that's the theme of the game, basically, is a group of people without a place to be, without a home, you know what I mean? With no real place where they're allowed to be and enjoy their lives. And all the characters kind of tie into that thematically. And that's, of course, tied to the villains in each arc, so to speak.
Very different from Persona 3 and 4, where the player character is always kind of the most popular kid in school and always seems to have just kind of a hold on everybody. Yeah, no, very charismatic.
It's funny because he's still a silent protagonist, but because of the situation he's in, he feels like he has more character right off the bat than Persona 3 or Persona 4's protagonist, because they just sort of come into the scene as a blank slate. You're introduced to this guy as someone who got arrested for a crime he may or may not have committed, and now everybody hates him. You know, you're the super underdog in this situation. And even the dialogue options you're given, you could play the game as a, tough guy jerk if you wanted to, and it ties into, what people's perceptions of you are. But as a result, though, the way you meet the other characters also feels a little bit more organic. In Persona 4, you're all in the same homeroom. Your first three party members are all in the same classroom. You're all classmates, so it just kind of comes together. But in Persona 5, nobody's friends with each other from the start. People have barely talked to each other up until, the point when you say something. So it really feels like you're getting it on the ground floor. And so, structure-wise, it's very similar. You're every day you're doing different tasks, you're doing jobs, you're doing, side quests, you're going into dungeons, etc. But the actual tone underneath all of it is a lot more serious. And sometimes it's a little bit hard to play in some senses and some points.
Have you seen Veronica Mars?
Yes, I have.
It's kind of Veronica Mars in that sense, right? So in Veronica Mars, it begins with a girl who used to be very popular, actually. And then a terrible event happens, and she ends up, kind of loses everything, right?
Yeah.
And becomes an outcast, and everybody hates her, and she ends up befriending, the other kid in the school who's also kind of an outcast. She's befriending the undesirables, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
And it's different from Persona 5 in that she kind of works her way back up the social ladder, but she's always still ostracized by the popular kids. And in that sense, it makes me think of what you're saying with the whole underdog story and everything.
Yeah, that definitely, the people he's friending, your main character's friending, they're absolutely, on the fringe. The first party member you get, again, this is super, super early in the game, his name is Ryuji, and he's the typical, school punk, basically. He has his shirt open, he gets into fights, he talks like a ruffian, and he has reasons for it, but nobody in the school treats him seriously. The teachers have all but abandoned him. They mock him to his face, etc., and you find out why, but, he has no friends at that school, and he's fine with it, but, you're also on that same sort of outskirts of the school structure, and so it makes more sense when the two of them eventually bump into each other. You see that friendship grow very organically because they can relate to each other.
So Persona 4 had a pretty similar cast to Persona 3.
Yeah.
You could see definite parallels between different cast members. True, they ended up having different stories and ultimately different personalities, but there were some broad similarities. Is that the case with Persona 5? It doesn't sound like it is. Like, the character you were just describing doesn't strike me as, like, a Yosuke type.
No, and, you know, a lot of people kind of jokingly they call him Yosuke. People haven't played the game yet because he's, you know, he's the first male friend you make. He's the best friend character. And, you know, in some ways he's a, when you get to know him better, he's a bit more of a goofball and kind of reckless. But, like, his story is messed up. Like, you immediately get why he is where he is pretty early on, and it immediately makes him sort of easy to like, because you just, you know, it's a screw-up situation that was completely out of his hands, but now he's taking the fall for it, and he just took it like a, you know, took it like a champ and decides, you know, screw the world, whatever. And I mean, even, you know, Anne is the first female character you get, and she's nothing like any of the other female characters in other Persona games, partially because she's a quarter American, so she's not full Japanese. So she already has that stigma on her. You know, she's she works as a model part-time, etc. But she's also quiet, and she doesn't have any friends at school. She barely ever talks. Which, if you watch the trailer, you would think, wait, that doesn't make any sense. That's not exactly the same character I'm describing. But she also goes through some really neat changes and stuff. And I don't have everybody yet, but so far, it's a very different cast from Persona 4 and Persona 3.
Are there any notable differences in the way that the social links work? So, if you haven't played Persona 4 or Persona 3, one of the key elements is you meet characters, and once you get to kind of introduce to them, you can start building up a bond with them, and it plays out in kind of a mini story arc. And the stronger the bond you have with them, the stronger that type of persona who is under their particular astrological sign becomes. And so if you build up a particular bond, you can create much more powerful personas, like, right out of the gate. Is that kind of the case in Persona 5?
That is still the case, but there are some differences in terms of what unlocks for each level of social link. So you have the generic, you know, you get more experience when you fuse personas of that level, but in addition to that, and I don't remember this being the case in Persona 4, correct me if I'm wrong, but for some of the social links, for example, if you do the social link with the doctor, she creates weird new medicines, and every time you level up the social link, more of those become available for you to purchase from her. You have the twins, who are the new Velvet room stewards, and when you level up their social link by fusing the personas they want from you, not only do you get more experience from the fusions, you also unlock new weird fusing abilities that have been added to the game. So depending on the social link, actually, there are more physical benefits to following certain characters. So, for example, I'm really pursuing the doctor right now because I want more health items. I want more items that restore SP. And by following her social link, I'm unlocking more of those. So you have a little bit more of a impetus to follow social links, even if you're not necessarily fusing personas of that tarot, which is nice.
Yeah, that sounds very cool. And it also sounds like they've really expanded the job stuff. So you're not just getting a little scene of you doing a job and potentially getting a social link. You're getting, like, an actual mini game.
Yeah, in some cases. I've only worked one job right now. I've been working at the flower shop.
Okay.
And what happens there is every once in a while you get a customer come in and they'll ask for a certain type of flower. They'll describe the sort of flower they want. And you have to pick out the right flowers. And if you do, you get a bonus in terms of cash, and you also get a bonus to your stats, your individual stats. And if you don't, I mean, you get paid the normal amount, but you don't get anything special out of it. So there are little things like that that make them more involved now. You know, you're actually paying more attention. They're not just little cutscenes.
What about the persona fusing? Is that different?
Not that I can tell. I did just unlock something that was, I think it's a persona strengthening. I don't know what that is. I haven't touched it yet. But generally speaking, fusions work the same way. You cannot choose which skills are, like, inherited. It's still a random list, which is kind of a bummer. But otherwise, it seems generally the same. Though there is a really great cutscene for when you fail to fuse a persona. That's just really morbid and kind of out there. But yeah,
no. Oh, man. Is it like the pig alien in Galaxy Quest?
It's something else, let me tell you. Like, the fusion animation is already pretty messed up because it involves sticking your personas into two guillotines to sacrifice and defuse them. And so the failed version is basically the twins taking it into their own hands to murder your personas.
Wow, that's...
It's dark. It's pretty dark. It fits in with the whole you're in prison thing.
That's interesting because one of the main things about this game is that it moves back to Tokyo. And of course, Tokyo is kind of SMT's spiritual homeland, yeah, right? There's always been a very apocalyptic feel to the series. And Persona 3 and Persona 4 certainly had their dark moments, don't get me wrong. But in moving to different environments, it felt like they lightened up a little bit. So it fits that when it would move back to Tokyo, that it would suddenly get a lot darker.
Yeah, you know, and the areas you can run around in, which are all based off of real areas in Tokyo, you know, there's some areas that just look super nasty and kind of grungy, like the area that you live in. And then you have Shibuya and Shinjuku, which are really lovingly rendered and stuff, but also populated. The nice thing about this game is that it's populated with, like, characters in the background walking around. And the way they do it is, if they're not an important NPC or someone you can talk to, they're kind of like these faceless, like, translucent beings that are just walking around. So you don't have to worry about running between people, but at the same time, it makes areas feel really packed in. Like, you feel like you're in a Tokyo area because you just see all these character models moving around everywhere all the time.
Mm. So, I'm guessing Tokyo is a lot bigger than the previous areas.
I'm not sure if it's bigger in terms of there are more areas, but the areas that are there are much larger than in Persona 4 and Persona 3. For example, you would have, like, there's that one area in Persona 4 by the river, which is that one street, and then, like, the area in the back by the park. There's no areas quite as small as that. Like, they're all kind of big city blocks with stores and shops on them and stuff.
Well, I think that Persona 5 is going to be one of those games that's just kind of fun to explore, relax, and enjoy, despite the kind of the dark tone. The art, like, I was wondering if the red would get to be a bit much, but it looked a bit more colorful than every time I see a trailer or something, it looks more colorful than I remember. Does that kind of hold up?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's only red and black in the same sense that, you know, Persona was yellow or that Persona 3 was blue. That's like the motif for like menus and stuff, but generally speaking, the game is really colorful, and that extends into costume designs, that extends to the UI, and that especially extends to dungeons, the main dungeons in the game, which is probably the biggest change in the Persona series since Persona 3 added all this stuff.
Yeah. Let's talk about the dungeons. It looks like they're a lot more elaborate this time around. They appear to be handcrafted as opposed to randomly generated. So in Persona 3, you would climb up this giant tower, Tartarus. Right? Yes, you would be climbing up the Tartarus, and each floor, like, was pretty nondescript. The point was that you were just kind of trying to survive until you got to the next point where you could kind of stop. And then the way that it shook things up was that you would hit a full moon, and then, like, a really nasty demon would appear, and you would have to deal with, like, some big new challenge. Persona 4, of course, you had the dungeons that were themed around each character's kind of inner selves, but they were still randomly generated and still kind of nondescript.
The window dressing around the dungeon looked different.
Exactly. Like, it was basically just reskinned. But Persona 5, it seems like, has, like, puzzles and much more elaborate handcrafted dungeons. Is this kind of borne out in what you've been playing?
Absolutely. I would argue that I didn't realize that making the game focus around handcrafted dungeons would make such a big difference, but it makes all the difference in the world. So I've only cleared 3 of them. I don't know how many there are in the game. I'll talk about the first one because it shows up a lot in trailers and stuff. The first dungeon in the game is it's a castle, essentially, right? And basically, they're called the palace dungeons. And the palaces are, like in Persona 4, they're kind of representative of the person you're in the consciousness of. And you're trying to steal the treasure at the very core of the palace. And that treasure is what that person holds dearest to them. And by stealing it, you basically you can force the person to the shadow to go back to the person and get them to confess to their deeds and reform as a person, become a better person. Even though they're still guilty of all their crimes, at least, you know, they're in prison now, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But these palace dungeons are all, like you said, handcrafted. They're hand-designed. They have puzzles and gimmicks in them. They have... The way the shadows are generated now, they don't just pop up out of the ground out of nowhere. They're on the map. They are designed after the theme of the dungeon. So, for example, in the castle, they're guards. You see guards walking around, and they have set paths they walk, almost like a Metal Gear game. And that ties into the fact that you now have stealth options, where you can hide in corners of walls and behind objects and stuff by pressing a button. And when you're in that position, enemies can't see you even if they're right in front of you. You're completely invisible to the naked eye. And when you're in that position and an enemy walks by you, if you press circle again, you'll see it pop up on screen. You stealth attack the enemy, and that gives you the first hit. So instead of just walking up behind them every single time, you can do this, and it's guaranteed. And that also makes it a lot more interesting to watch how enemies move, because when you're sort of low on health and low on SP and you absolutely need to get that chance hit, you're much more stealthy about it. And again, it makes it very easy for you to do that. But yeah, you also get puzzles. You get things like riddles. The dungeons are sort of populated by things called safe rooms. When you find them, you can save in them. You can check your progress in the dungeon. If you ask Morgana, who's your new guide, the cat character, he will tell you about how far into the dungeon you are. And also, while you're in that room, you can teleport to any other safe room that you've been to. So if you get, you know, 3 safe rooms into the dungeon, you're pretty deep in, but you need to back out. You don't have to run out. You press R1, and you can teleport to any of those safe rooms or to the entrance of the dungeon. And so you still go back into the dungeon like you did before, sort of pacing yourself, but you're almost a lot more inclined to try and do it in a couple days, because there are these kind of set fun experiences, and you kind of want to see what happens next. The environments are really nice, like, they're really well designed. I haven't had this much fun doing a dungeon in a JRPG in a really long time, actually. It's been fantastic.
Oh, that is really good to hear. And the handcrafted dungeons sounds like a giant improvement.
It's huge, yeah.
And it really goes a long way to explaining why this game was in development for such a long time. Because, creating those handcrafted dungeons could not have been easy, but I think that the effort is definitely going to end up being worth it.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing is that they have to be huge, too, because they have to last for, you know, a couple weeks' time in-game. But it's interesting that you mentioned how long it took to make this. I was reading an interview today that Katsura Hashino, the producer, did with, I think it was Dengeki PlayStation, and they said that in 2011, when the earthquake hit, Tohoku earthquake, they actually pretty much reset the game entirely.
Whoa, really?
From scratch, yeah. Because at first, it was going to be a story about going on a journey, leaving your home and then and going out into the open world and stuff and sort of exploring who you are as a person. But after that earthquake, they start to rethink the themes and stuff, and they thought that a game about these sort of themes was more important right now. And they ended up kind of scrapping a lot of what they had and going back to zero. They even explored making combat action-based.
Holy crap.
So turn-based. Apparently it didn't last very long because they realized they didn't have much experience with it and they didn't want to screw it up. But yeah, in 2011 there was a big change. And I know when Index was going through its legal troubles due to its presence being criminals, apparently he also expressed concern that at the time they weren't even sure the game was going to be released because of how, you know, the situation was with Index and Yakuza and all that crazy shit that was going down.
Jesus.
Yeah. So fortunately, it's kind of a minor miracle that the game turned out this, like, amazing piece of software that it did, at least at this point.
It sounds like the game went through some trials, to say the least, and the fact that they rebooted it after the earthquake kind of explains its much darker and more apocalyptic feel.
Yeah, and it also explains why it seems like it's a very introspective game. Like, the game is about these characters kind of looking deep inside themselves and deep inside other people and trying to generally fix themselves, right? Like, all the villains in this game so far are, I could absolutely point to real criminal cases in Japan in the last 5 years where these exact sort of things have happened. Like, the inspiration is super clear in some cases. Like, there's one that is very clearly riffing off of that Japanese politician. I don't know if you ever saw the clip the Japanese politician who was apologizing for having, like, extorted money and stuff. He just starts crying in the middle of his speech, and he's drinking the water. And there's this huge thing on Japanese internet, memes everywhere. And it's very clearly something that's riffing on that in this. That kind of caught me off guard, but it was also pretty funny, too. But it's definitely more tied to social problems. Like, I feel like a Japanese person plays... It's a very Japanese game in a way that the others weren't. I was talking to a localization friend of mine, Thomas Jane, and he was saying the same thing, that, like, in some very, like, built-in ways, this is a Japanese game about very Japanese problems that speaks to Japanese people, and the localization is going to have a lot of work to do to try and fill in those gaps, because otherwise you miss some of the nuance that comes with, like, okay, this is specifically about Japanese school structures and how oppressive they can be and how parents turn a blind eye to, like, physical abuse for the sake of, you know, the greater good, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, no, it's definitely a dark game, but it has its light moments for sure.
Yeah. Well, one of the strengths of Atlas has always been that they've been able to accentuate the Japanese cultural aspects, yeah, without making it feel alien to, exactly, Westerners. And that's why I feel like it has resonated so strongly over, yeah, here. But it also explains why it's not coming out until a few months after the Japanese release, because not only do they have, like, more than 100 hours worth of text to localize, it sounds like it is the most intense undertaking Atlas has ever taken on, Atlas USA has ever taken on. They also have to do this, like, really intensive actual localization process. And if anybody starts talking about censorship, I will personally climb through the internet and, like, throttle them.
God. It's funny to me, this game doesn't really have much that would, quote-unquote, require censoring to begin with. But, like, the other thing that I really, I feel for the folks at Atlas is that, like, in addition to just text translation and localization, the amount of stuff in the UI that they're going to have to tinker with is,
oh God, yes, yes.
Like, every time I play the game, I just think to myself, thank God I don't work at Atlas right now, because this would be hell on earth.
The UI is so elaborate. Like, every time I see that UI, I'm just like, oh my God, that is,
and I am not gorgeous staring at it. But the funny thing is, it's not just that it looks amazing and feels amazing. There are actually, like, quality of life improvements that go along with it. Like, the combat system, I haven't seen a lot of people talking about it, but the menu system now, every single option on your combat ring is set to a face button. So square, circle, triangle, etc. So, like, persona is triangle, attack is X, block is square or whatever. Like, and it makes it really just easy to pick what you want. Like, you're not cycling through things up and down with the D-pad.
Yeah, you're not going through the little menu ring.
Super fast at all times. And everything, like, just looks so cool that even if you're doing battles back to back to back, you don't really even care, because it's just so stylish. It's absurd. It's not like the game is some sort of technical marvel either. I mean, it does have some issues where, like, for some reason there's some textures here and there that are, like, really oddly low res, where it makes you wonder, like, was that a holdover from, like, a previous version or what? But, like, on the whole, just the arts, there's so much art in this game, it's absurd. And I mean that in the sense of, like, there's 2D art for, like, everything. There's, like, a nice 2D illustration for, like, the battle victory screen. But on top of that, there's also this really elaborate animation of your characters getting up and heading to the next, you know, area after battle. There's all these different, like, context-sensitive things that it seems absurd that a company like Atlas, which is not a AAA developer, they don't have that kind of manpower, they don't have that sort of money, like, that they created this thing somehow without, you know, imploding the studio is almost like a minor miracle to me.
5 years. 5 years after they rebooted the project. I mean, that is just crazy, and I really hope that it pays dividends for them. Last couple things. Thoughts on the battle system?
So the battle system, like I said, the UI improves a lot of things. It makes it nice and fast. There are two big changes, or I guess return to form, depending on how you look at it. They've added guns back in the game, which was a Persona thing from Persona 1 and Persona 2, and also the SMT series. And they also added back demon negotiation, which was also
Persona 1
and Persona 2. So in a lot of ways, this feels like the culmination of like combining the positives from both sets of games.
I look forward to them asking me a random question and then just like going, nope, bye.
they're running off. A little bit better about that. In fact, most of the time, I've only had them turn on me mid-conversation, like maybe 4 or 5 times out of the hundreds of times I've done it. You're more likely to get them to give you something than to like, have them be angry. But there's lots of funny, weird, goofy dialogue and goofy choices that... That's kind of like the best part of the demon negotiation systems is just the weird conversations you have with these creatures. But the nice thing is there's 2 ways to recruit demons now. There's negotiation, and then there's also when you get an enemy down to a certain level of health, if other enemies are already dead, they panic and they talk to you instead. They come to you. They're like, hey, please, you know, spare me. And you can choose to obviously kill them, extort money from them, or take them. And if you take them, it's a guaranteed persona acquisition. Like, it's not left up to chance. And for a while, I thought it was kind of it was a hard thing to do. But recently, with certain demons that I'm not good with talking to, you can pretty much guarantee that they'll surrender to you if you kill every other demon on the battlefield and get them down to, like, a sliver of health. Which is nice, because just having options is good. The other thing they had, like I said, was guns. And each character has a different gun type, rifles, shotguns, etc. They have a limited amount of bullets, so when you go into the dungeon, if you have 15 bullets, those are your 15 bullets for that dungeon run. When you leave and come back, you'll get more. But they're basically they're a type of attack, so just like an SMT. Some characters are weak, some demons are weak against them, some aren't. But they're good for, like, creating opportunities for all-out attacks. It's nice to have them back. You feel like you have a lot of combat options. The other new thing they added was baton touch, or baton touch, depending on how you pronounce it. When you hit an enemy in their weak spot, you have the potential to baton touch to another character. Sometimes you get to choose them, sometimes they're set because of the character order. And when you do, it changes to that character's turn, and they'll be a little bit more powered up than beforehand. So, for example, you know, if I take down an enemy with ice and the remaining enemy is weak against lightning, I can switch to the lightning character using baton touch. They'll be more powerful and they'll be able to use the lightning attack to finish off the guy. So it feels a lot more complex, but at the same time, it's very fast and it just feels good.
All right. Last question. And I think this is one that a lot of people are kind of wondering. How long does it take from the time that you start the game for the first time and the first time that you actually kind of really get into the flow of the game? Like, how long does it take for this game to clear its throat?
First time from beginning to time where you touch the controller to move around is about 10 minutes.
Okay.
No, I'm sorry. What am I talking about, 10 minutes? It's about 5 minutes before you're in battle and running around a dungeon. From start of game to you pick up the controller and you're fighting things.
So it's not like Persona 4, in other words?
No. The game starts in media res. And so you're probably 80 hours into the game at the very beginning of the game. Like, everybody's already together. You're trying to break out of a casino. You get into some tutorial fights. You do some tutorial stealth stuff. You break out, and then the game flashes all the way back to the beginning of the year. And that's when you get sort of the typical persona build-up. But even then, the game doesn't take the control out of your hands for too long. I'd say until you really hit, like, doing whatever you want, probably 2 hours. But in that 2-hour period, you're still doing stuff. You're not just, like, Persona 4 was very much so, like, I remember the one gameplay thing that I did was walking forward in that endless hallway the very beginning. And then all the way up until Yusuke's shadow, there isn't much you ever do. Persona 5 isn't quite like that. Like, it is a much faster progression to things get breaking apart, I guess you could say.
Well, I didn't think that I could get any more hyped for Persona 5, but you have definitely turned my hype levels up to 11.
Yeah, we keep going up.
I cannot wait to play it. It's going to come in the mail. I will be doing a preview, an import preview, and I will also be streaming it next week. I really cannot wait to play this game. And I think the thing that I find really interesting when you're talking about the way that it's combining these SMT elements, I know that a lot of SMT fans, like hardcore SMT fans, in some ways have looked down their nose at the Persona series because it's a lot more accessible, a lot more, say, mainstream than your average SMT game. So maybe we can finally bring everybody back together in one big happy family.
Yeah, you know, I would hope so, but I feel like it also sometimes goes both ways. Like, you have some Persona fans who look at SMTs like, why doesn't this have social links? And then you have the SMT fans who are like, oh, I don't want social links in my game, ugh. And it's like, guys, we should be happy. You know why? Because Atlus is making not just Persona or not just SMT. They're making both. Like, it's actually a pretty good time to be a fan of either of these right now.
I absolutely agree. And we will talk about SMT Apocalypse in the next segment, but we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Got you running through, hold on, think again, don't you know, weren't you stuttering? Sure we got the clue, how about this we go, don't you know, no more art. And as you look to the horizon, not a cloud, by the storm.
All right, we're back. We are going to continue to talk about SMT Apocalypse, which I'm not actually sure if it's out yet. I know that Jeremy has been playing it for seemingly months at this point, because we got our copy, we got codes for that game like a long time ago.
They sent those out early.
Which is great and all. It's funny because Persona 5 is being hyped to the moon, but SMT 4, you know, in some ways is, despite being a numbered sequel to the series, has been kind of taking a back seat a little bit. But SMT Apocalypse, kind of a spin-off slash, I don't know, almost like a side story from SMT 4, even though it picks up after SMT 4. What I have played so far, you do not play as the original main character, who is Flynn. You begin by taking on the role of a soldier in one of the factions who live in Tokyo. And it picks up relatively quickly and goes from there. Elliot, you have played SMT Apocalypse. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I cleared it back when it released in February in Japan. I really liked Shin Megami Tensei 4. I liked 3 a lot. I liked Nocturne a lot, but I'm a big fan of SMT 1 and 2. Especially the tone of 2, that weird kind of 80s sci-fi horror vibe that it had going on. So 4 really appealed to me, and when I saw, you know, the trailer for Apocalypse, which really looked like it was kind of digging deep into that sci-fi horror weirdness that 4 had going on, I was all about it. I played through the game pretty much straight without stopping to play other stuff, and I really enjoyed it. And like you said, it's a weird thing, because from the outside, it doesn't look like it's a sequel. It kind of looks like a weird spin-off thing. You're not following the same characters. It doesn't even follow the right timeline. But it all sort of starts to fall into place the more you play it, like where it sits in terms of Shin Megami Tensei 4. It starts off from a point of the neutral ending, but not the end of the neutral ending from 4. It kind of replaces the back half of the neutral path. In some ways, it kind of feels like this is, for that team, this is kind of like, okay, well, this is the canonical, neutral path. Like, you switch characters, but this is what's supposed to happen along. Because I felt like that was one of the weakest parts of 4, was that, the neutral path and the neutral ending really felt kind of rushed. So this actually fixed a lot of my problems with that. You know, the biggest problem with the game, honestly, and I say problem, but it didn't actually bother me that much, is that, yeah, it reuses a lot of assets, it reuses a lot of locations, etc. But I also feel like Atlus is kind of known for doing that when it comes to their 3D games. I mean, there was a long period of time where they were just using the same demon sprites for every single SMT-branded game possible. You know what I mean? Like Strange Journey, Delver Survivor, all those games just use the same static images over and over again. So I was kind of used to that. But I wanted to play in SMT4's Tokyo more, was originally my issue with 4. And so like, mm-hmm. being able to do that with all these quality of life improvements, a new story, new characters, improved combat, like improved illustrations for some of those demons, was kind of a treat, to be honest. I didn't expect this game to ever exist, so the fact that it does and it's good was a really pleasant surprise to me.
It's really funny that this game exists. I thought that they had kind of closed the book on SMT4, especially with the 3DS kind of definitely on the downward side of its life cycle, and all of a sudden this giant RPG is being dropped right back into our laps.
And it is a big, it's a very big game. People talk about how disappointed they are that it isn't on consoles, but think about what it would take to put a game the size of SMT4 or Apocalypse on a modern console. Like, we're talking about Persona 5 earlier, but those are closed areas, small areas of the city. You're talking about 5-6 hubs versus a game like SMT4 or Apocalypse where, you're running around huge chunks of these cities. Now imagine having to do that on the PS4 with the manpower that Atlas has. Not to mention you have to make all those demons, which, they did for Persona 5 finally. I'm sure you're going to see those get used nonstop going forward. But that would be this would be a huge undertaking on a modern console for a small company. And so I think the only reason it ever existed in the first place was because it was on the 3DS. There's no way they'd be able to do a SMT4 and a Persona 5 side-by-side for the PS4, PS3. I feel like that actually bankrupt the company. But that said, SMT4 sold really well in Japan. Like, despite the fact that it's technically the Mothership series, but Persona is sort of the Mothership series now, it still sells quite well. I mean, 4 did like 200,000 its opening week, give or take, which is nothing to laugh at, especially if you look at Persona numbers.
I mean, it was on the 3DS, and SMT is well known in Japan. Yeah. I'm not surprised at all.
So, in the West, Persona, trumps SMT in terms of name value, I think. But in Japan, people still look at the SMT brand and think, oh yeah, that's some quality stuff, even if it's not Persona. But yeah, I was just happy that Apocalypse exists, and I'm happy they released it in the West too.
Yep, indeed. And well, if you want additional thoughts on SMT Apocalypse, you should go read Jeremy's review over on the site. I really wanted him to get on the podcast, but Jeremy is an elusive man, and he is a tough guy to get on the show, but I'm glad that you could speak to it. I'm really curious, what are your overall thoughts on SMT4? Overall a success? Good addition to the series?
It's not Nocturne, but I don't think it was ever trying to even be like Nocturne. SMT3, Nocturne, in some ways, despite being the big popular one in the West, is almost like the black sheep of the series. People like to talk about how they love the isolated feeling that Nocturne has, and that's what SMT is to them. But that wasn't actually what SMT was before Nocturne. In SMT 1 and 2, you had human characters that were with you. You had partners. You had a cast of characters. Tokyo was populated with people in both games. You had huge factions, of humans going against each other. Then you get to Nocturne. That's very sort of lonely game on purpose, and it's very cool, but it's very different from the SMT formula, I felt like. And so when SMT4 rolled around, and no one had ever played the first two games because they never got released in the West until the phone version not too long ago, it was sort of weird seeing people react to it, why isn't this Nocturne? This isn't SMT, etc., etc., when it was such a return to the style of 1 and 2. But I think they're great games. I think Atlas did some really bang up work on the 3DS. Apocalypse recycles a lot of stuff, yes, but I think what's there is still great. And I think if you liked 4, you'd like Apocalypse. And if you didn't like 4 for things like the map, the Tokyo map, which was confusing,
I hated that stupid
map. Didn't have Tokyo memorized. Apocalypse fixes that.
You know how long it took me to find Ueno?
But yeah, Apocalypse fixes a lot of that. There's a lot of quality of life changes for the better. So I highly recommend, if you wanted to like 4 but couldn't, check out Apocalypse. Read a wiki, see what happened in the neutral path real quick, and just jump on in, because it's a great SMT game.
All right. Anything else that you have been playing? I know that you said before the podcast that you played through Tales of Berseria.
Yeah, so I just want to talk about this real quickly, because Tales has been on kind of a weird slump for me. I haven't really liked any of the PlayStation 3 Tales games very much. I like parts of Zestiria, which was the last one. I didn't like either of the Exilia games. I didn't like Graces. I liked Vesperia, which was Xbox 360 first. But I kind of
Vesperia is a decade old at this point.
Exactly. Yeah.
Can you believe how old that game is? Still great.
I try not to think about it.
It's actually one of the high points of the series, in my opinion, alongside Tales of The Abyss. And
Tales of Abyss is good. I think it's a shame that we never got the later 2D Tales games, because Tales of Destiny Director's Cut and Tales of Destiny 2 are,
I really wish that they
had the best games in the series.
Yeah, the PS2 remake of Destiny would have been really nice to have.
It's amazing. So I wasn't really hyped for Berseria at all. It kind of just, after Zestiria, it just didn't, I wasn't feeling it. I picked it up anyway. And honestly, it was a race against time to finish it before Persona 5 came out, but I didn't really have to work that hard because I ended up sitting down with it and just, after a week, go like zooming right through it.
I want your superpower. I want your superpower to just blitz these games.
Blitz these games and then have to blitz work right after.
Yeah, seriously.
But like, it's probably my favorite 3D Tales game. I think I like it overall better than Vesperia. I think it has the best cast of a recent Tales game. I think the story it tells is it's a simple revenge story, but it works. The tone is a little bit darker, but it's consistent. The combat is the most fun it's been in ages. The amount of combos you can pull off and the way the game feels is fantastic. Cutscene direction is way better than it's been recently, which is pretty bad. The music is still, you know, Sakuraba being Sakuraba, but, you know, it's mostly okay. But there's just a lot to the game. There's lots of side quests. It's a very meaty game, and it feels like the Tales team kind of took to heart what the criticism they've been getting for the last few games. It's a shame that like it's actually one of the worst-selling Tales games in Japan, because the series has been on a decline. And it's kind of a bummer, because it's absolutely the best of the bunch. And it's kind of been showing, because it's had some legs in terms of sales. Like, people are still buying the game, even though Tales games are normally very front-loaded. It has good word of mouth. But hopefully it sells a little bit better in the West, because it's actually rock solid. I was very surprised, especially because I picked it up knowing that I was going to go into Persona 5 right after, so I figured I'd just forget about Berseria completely later on. But as it turns out, like, I still look back on that game very fondly.
The Tales series has a very specific audience who are very hardcore about the series, and Bandai Namco and the Tales studio seems to be catering especially to them. A lot of women, actually, which I think is really cool.
You know, a lot of people don't talk about it, but they have a lot of live events in Japan where, you know, they just announce games or have the voice actors come or whatever. And you'll get, you know, like 30,000 people in the audience, and 95% of them will be women. You know, the Tales franchise is not just the game sales. The Tales franchise is all the figures, all the posters, all the manga, all the anime. And the people who devour most of that stuff... I was reading a study not too long ago. I feel like it was a couple of years ago. The majority of the people who are buying all that, you know, outside goods, they're all women. Like, Tales has a gigantic female fan base, probably larger than the male fan base. And they know that. They absolutely are more than aware.
Well, it's kind of bright. And, like, look, as a woman myself, I don't really want to say, like, all women want the same thing, because that's obviously not true.
Of course, yeah.
But I think that there is kind of an appealing, like, brightness to the series that makes it a lot easier for it to kind of break out of, like, this niche of men playing RPGs or whatever. It has very pretty male characters.
It does. You know, the Tales team knows how to appeal to both sides, so to speak.
And they're usually cute to the point of being, like, saccharine. I mean...
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah.
But then they'll have the dude who just has his abs out for no reason, and it's just like, cool. All
right. Yep. A lot of women are like, mm-hmm.
Yeah, not totally.
All right. So, I suppose the last thing I'm kind of wondering, what did you think of the Moon Dwellers? This would be Super Robot Wars OG, the Moon Dwellers, for the PlayStation 4, the first Super Robot Wars game in years to be in English.
So, I didn't play the English version, but I have seen lots of screenshots of
it. Oh my god, that localization is so bad.
I hesitate to call it a localization, but something else.
Let's put localization in air quotes. They obviously, I don't know where they sent it, but it sure wasn't a native English speaking company.
The same place they sent Sword Art Online a couple of years ago, which was also just one of the most disturbing professional localizations I've ever seen in my life.
It's borderline word salad.
Which is funny, because both these games, you know, will sell reasonably well, and it just, I have no idea.
Before you get into it, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I will just say that the important thing is that the menus work. You're not going to know what the heck is going on in the story, because it's just all word salad. But you can actually navigate the game if you don't know Japanese. And weirdly enough for me, it was actually harder because I was so used to the Japanese, like, the Japanese characters that I was just like, what is this ability? Terminology doesn't mean anything to me.
Yeah, like, you just made up a word. I already knew this tech. Oh, God.
Anyway, you played the Japanese version.
I didn't beat it. I haven't cleared it yet. I only played a little bit because I didn't have much time before stuff started coming out in rapid succession. But it's another, it's very pretty OG game, which shouldn't surprise anybody. It's always nice to get the full body portraits back. It's nice to have maps that aren't just pictures of heads. From what I was playing, despite the fact that they were kind of billing it as a mainline game, it definitely feels like a side story. Which is fine. That's probably for the better in terms of releasing to the West in English for the first time.
Quote unquote. Yeah, I mean, you still have to import it.
Exactly. But I think as far as picking a title goes, it's probably a good place to start, just because it's not quite as tied down in baggage. That said, it's still stars.
Oh, it's still tied down in base baggage.
Jay, and has characters from Super Robot Wars Jay, which is a Game Boy Advance Super Robot Wars game. And it still has all the baggage that comes with being an OG title and having, you know, three or four games behind it, depending on how you count them. It seems solid. Didn't seem as good as the last one on the PS3. But in terms of, like, a interim game, I was definitely having fun with it. It's just beautiful, you know?
Yeah. I haven't played as much as I would have liked, which is why I haven't written about it. I did stream it, though. Are you excited for SD Gundam G-Generation Genesis?
So I've never played I remember you were telling me about G-Generation a few podcasts prior to this, and I still haven't played a G-Generation game, so I've been looking into, like, trailers and stuff. And, like, the style just reminds me a lot of Super Robot Wars, which is a positive. So,
but it's different in a lot of respects, because you don't have a full-on campaign for the most part. You're playing kind of greatest hits from the different shows.
Yes, I don't know. Like,
and then you're also, like, the main goal of the game is basically to build up a squad of all of your favorite robots. And you start out with the very basic versions. But as you progress, you, like, grind more money, you level up, what's interesting is it's interesting to figure out how to get the robots that you actually want, because you have to have some knowledge of how the suits progress in the different shows in order to get hold of them. So you'll be like, because you evolve them, right? Like, you get them to a certain level and then you can, like, level them up, or you can evolve them to the next level suit. And it might be like a modified version or whatever. Like, you would start out with, like, the basic goof, and then that's how you would move up to the goof custom, right? And the goof custom can become other stuff. And there are, like, 9 different types of the original, like, Gundam. And so you kind of, like, you try to find families of mobile suits from different shows, and that's how you unlock other ones. And sometimes you can just exchange it. Like, if you have a high enough level suit, you can just check the exchange, and it'll, like, give you 4 different choices. And you'll go, oh, well, I'll just drop, like, 100,000 coins on this suit that I want that I don't know how to unlock, but now I have that suit, and that opens up even more options. And a lot of that game is the thrill of the chase, I suppose you would say, in that you're like going, man, once I have these suits, I'm going to be so happy. I'm going to have, like, the V2, and I'm going to have the suit from Unicorn, and I'm the full frontal suit.
Just saying it.
I'm gonna get, like, I'm gonna drop it on to the Argama, and so I'm gonna have, that's gonna be my capital ship, and I'm gonna have all these characters flying the different suits. I'm gonna have the Turn A in there. And then once you have the entire, like, crew, you're like, Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Pretty much done.
I don't know if that's
yeah,
what you're
like,
hiring for.
I've always made it to the final. The final like level. But inevitably, I just go, all right, I'm time for me to move on from this game.
I feel like I really need like a solid campaign to keep me there, but we'll see.
I would say give it a shot. You would be surprised how addictive it is, and it's a lot of fun to kind of play these greatest hits from the different shows. So check that out. And of course, next year we have another mainline SRW game coming out, though it's more of a spin-off-y type thing.
I heard it's okay.
I'm betting that the map is going to look like the Vita version again. Oh, if that's the case,
it looks
no
like
sale.
Using the same like sprites from those games. So,
I picked it up again recently on the PS3, and the overhead map on the PS3, it just doesn't work. I might actually rebuy it on the Vita because I think that's the only way I can enjoy that that version of the series.
Like playing it on the Vita feels much more natural than whenever I've seen it on like a big screen for the PS3. Like it feels like a blown up Vita game, which feels terrible. I hate that feeling. So like I'd almost recommend just hopping over to the Vita for that.
Yeah, and they've been updating they had been updating individual suits like the new Gundam and stuff. But at its heart, it feels like it's still based on an engine from the PSP version.
There's no way that they're not still using the PSP Z engine that they started with. Like,
which looked amazing in 2011 on the PSP. It looked great. I loved it. It's 2016, man.
That series they need to put a little bit more money back into that series.
It needs to. Well, I mean, the Moon Dweller looks so good, right?
It's just like, oh, I can actually follow this story because it's not just tiny little square heads talking to each other.
Well, Z is finished, thank God. Splitting those games into two parts was a real mistake. The second parts of both Z2 and Z3 were so much better than the first parts, but I was always burned out when I got to the second part.
You always get to the second part, and you're like, I don't know if I want to keep playing this anymore.
Which is unfortunate, because that was where all the best parts are, all the best story arcs, all of the best units, all of the best characters. Like, if you wanted to finally freaking get to the end of Gurren Lagann, you had to be at the end of, you had to play all the way to Super Robot Wars Z3 2. And it's like, this is a bridge too far for me. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, the back ends, they load the back ends way too much.
Yeah, a little too much. I hope that whenever, I'm sure they're going to start a new arc, probably on like the PS4 or something. Yeah. Which, by the way, new Gundam versus Gundam on the PS4.
Yes.
Can you believe that?
So excited.
Next generation starting on console. Man, that says a lot about the state of arcades in Japan right now.
I'm so excited for that. That was like the bombshell they dropped at TGS that like seven people got really excited for in the West, and everybody else was just like, oh, another dumb Gundam game. And meanwhile,
People really understand the significance of this. Like,
it's a huge, like, that's not like another dumb
no,
Gundam
absolutely
game. That's
not.
Like, it's huge.
Gundam Versus is a big deal in the East, and it has traditionally been an arcade series, and I'm sorry, this is straying way beyond the scope of an RPG podcast, but
it's Gundam. Gundam always finds its way.
Yes, Gundam always finds its way, and it looked like the series was going to be arcade only for the foreseeable future, but I guess the online connections just didn't work out for them, and they're just like, nope, time to go console.
Well, I know they're saying that like this is going to be strictly console, a console series, and they're going to keep doing the arcade series separate, and I think they're going to have just two different series running parallel. That way they don't have to worry about, like,
Bandai Namco, release this one in the West, for God's sake.
I think this is part of it, too, is that they can start fresh and sort of look at the roster, take another look at the roster, and then see, you know, how licensing and stuff like that is going to work. Because, I mean, Bandai Namco literally releases everything now in the West, even the most like absurd tiny anime game. Like, they released, I want to say a few months ago, this like action RPG for the Vita called like The Asterisk War, which is based on this like light novel anime that like not that many people watched, but they still released and quote unquote localized the game and put it out digitally for the Vita. Like,
Yeah, they also released that horrible Versus game for the Vita.
Yeah, you know, like, with the that said, that Versus game got a lot better through patches.
Oh, yeah?
They patched in, like, actual arcade modes. They patched in, like, 15 free suits.
Oh, shit.
A bunch of different new modes. It still has no online, but now it's actually a Versus game.
I have a code. I need to play this thing.
Definitely. Do all the updates and, like, you know, it's fun for having a Versus game on your console. You can't play with anybody else unless, you know, they have it. But, like, if you just want to get to a couple matches real quick, it's perfect now.
All right. So, with that, I think that it is time to call it quits on this episode of Axe of the Blood God, which is a US Gamer podcast. We usually talk about RPGs, but when I get Elliot on here, I just got to get my Gundam on, as it were. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and various other podcast outlets. You can follow me on Twitter at @_catbot. You should go, if you enjoyed Elliot's conversations, you can see him talk about Japanese games on Twitter at Ryoga Saotome. I believe that's spelled RYOUGASAOTOME.
Perfect.
So yeah, go check him out. And are you still blogging?
I still blog every now and then. I stream a lot now. I don't blog as much because just work takes up all my time, but...
Oh, where do you stream? What's your Twitch channel?
Twitch.tv/ElliotRyo. That's ElliotRyo.
Yeah, go subscribe to him.
All Japanese games all the time.
Yeah, exactly. If you want to see the Persona 5 in action and get some serious spoilers, there you go, right? Exactly. And, of course, follow our streams, too, at Twitch.tv/USGamerNet. Make sure to subscribe to us. And... well, you know, whenever we start streaming, usually stream at least twice a week, you will know about it. And of course, we export all of our streams to YouTube at USGamerNet. Follow us on all of the social medias, like us on Facebook, USGamer, also on the Twitter at USGamerNet. Please go and subscribe to our flagship podcast, From Us to You, where this week we talked about Destiny Rise of Iron, a game that I have boycotted for this podcast because I don't want to talk about a co-op shooter. That's just how it is. Like, I'm putting my foot down, gosh darn it. I know that it has RPG stuff. At its heart, it goes down with the MMORPG genre, but I just cannot get into this series, and I'm just like, you know what? I'm not going to force it.
Seems fair to me.
I'm not going to force it. Let's just talk about some Persona 5 here.
I am damn down for that.
All right. So, this has been another episode of Axe of Blood God. I've been Cat Bailey, and for Elliot, thanks so much for coming on the show, as always. And until next time, happy adventuring. To see